Hey, I'm Kirk Harnack. Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, Chris Tobin is with us, and we're at WHRO in Hampton Roads, Virginia, talking about technology, old to new. Ray Lenz, the Senior Director of Engineering here for radio, is going to be here. Also, my friend John Heimerl. Hi, John.
And we're going to talk old school to way new school technologies.
I can't wait. It's coming up on This Week in Radio Tech.
Our show is brought to you by Lavo and the Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Console. Crystal Clear is the console with a multi-touch touchscreen interface. By Direct Current Broadcast e-newsletter. Get Direct Current in your inbox every Thursday with technical pointers putting you and your facility at an advantage. And by the Axia Radius AOIP audio console. It's a standalone console that also networks. Spend less and get more with Axia Radius.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. It's the show where we talk about radio technology, everything from the microphone. Look, we got two of them here this week, to the light bulb at the top of the tower, the antennas, and all that stuff. We're live on location here. I'm Kirk Harnack. I work for the folks at the Telos Alliance, so if you notice a slight bias, that's probably why. And we're here with, we're on location in Hampton Roads, Virginia. And I'm going to introduce you, in just a minute, to this guy right here. Not yet. We're going to keep this powder dry for a minute and bring in our co-host, Chris Tobin, who is, he's in a techie place. Chris, welcome in.
Why, thank you. Yes, as I mentioned earlier, before we began, I am high atop of a skyscraper here in New York City in a TV combiner room that also shares space with public safety, broadcast, internet service providers, and a few other things I can't mention. And what's behind me is a microwave relay rack for one of the organizations to interconnect buildings or points of presence around the city and I think across the Hudson at about 22 gigahertz point-to-point microwaves.
Wow. You have the coolest places, Chris, that you show up at. Does the landlord know you're there?
Yes. Oh, yeah, they know that I do this,
okay.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
And the manager of the floor, he's also a former broadcast engineer, so...
You know,
things of what we do.
I don't know, Chris, if you had time to get the memo, but we're going to talk about public radio and how the face of public radio has been changing. And I think in a couple ways, at least behind the scenes in the engineering world, I see public radio doing some things that we've been doing in commercial radio for a while. I'm not saying they're lagging behind. I'm just saying that the production style, the style of creating content is in public radio is in some ways similar to what I think we've been doing in commercial for a while. So, you know, a lot of IP connectivity and even having a talent that's out of the station. I don't know, maybe public radio's been doing that for a while, but we're going to find out as we talk with a couple of engineers here at WHRO. So let me bring in Ray Lenz, L-E-N-Z, is that
that's
right?
That's correct.
Yeah, Ray Lenz. And you're the senior, what, engineer?
Senior radio engineer.
Ah. Okay.
And that basically means I take care of the studios. We do have a senior RF engineer who takes care of all the transmitters, and I'm more than glad to let him do that.
So we're at WHRO and named, I guess, for Hampton Roads, and that's this area in Virginia?
The HRO stands for Homeroom 1, and 50 years ago or so?
Back then it was Title I.
Back then it was called Tidewater.
Ah.
And 50-some years ago, they put together this station as a television station, producing educational programs for the classroom, specifically for the classroom. And so that's why they called it Homeroom 1, WHRO.
But they didn't. So was there not a Hampton Roads then?
It was called Tidewater back then. But they've become Hampton Roads.
They named Hampton Roads after WHRO. That's pretty cool. That's an amazing feat.
There you go.
A lot of influence there.
So Hampton Roads consists of Norfolk and Virginia Beach and Chesapeake and Suffolk. And Newport News and Hampton.
Okay.
So save the Hampton for the last. But that's Hampton Roads, the Seven Cities area. And WHRO and WHRV, the public radio stations in this area, all under one roof, serve that audience.
So obviously we're in a production studio here, right?
Yes, we're in Production B.
Okay. And give you the whole story here in just a minute. We got stories to tell about, well, why I'm here in the SBE chapter that had a day-long meeting here for radio and TV engineers. We're going to take a little look at this studio and how WHRO was a very early adopter of audio over IP technology. They've had it in place now for almost 9 years. So that's pretty cool right there. They're obviously kind of on the forefront of technology there. And I just got a tour of this place, and it's a very active place. They do a lot of production here, and they do it with a lot of IP technology. So that's all coming up. Chris Tobin will have some more words about where he is in that secret undisclosed transmission location in Manhattan, high up on top of a skyscraper. But first, we're going to visit our first sponsor, and that is the folks at Lavo, LAWO, Lavo. And I'm going to jump off mic here for just a second while I get my copy ready. You know, most of you know me, Kirk Harnack, as a broadcast engineer. I do on-air work, and I'm the host of this show, TWRT. What you may not know is that I've also sold broadcast equipment internationally, and that job took me all around the world. I've seen a lot of broadcasting in a lot of countries and the different imaginative ways that people do things. I got to tell you, they're fascinating. They really are how broadcasters work around the world. One of the reasons I'm excited to introduce you to our sponsor, Lavo. That's LAWO, but pronounced Lavo.com. Lavo is famous for the world of television, audio and video, especially for high-profile event coverage like the Olympics, World Cup soccer, and the Grammy Awards. When the broadcast is mission critical, you're pretty likely to find Lavo there. Well, you wouldn't believe how this stuff is built. Everything is really over-engineered and redundant. Even their backups have backups. And because there are no do-overs in live event broadcasting, dead event can kill your career. It might kill you in a couple of countries I've been to. In Russia, dead air killed you. Now you've been thinking, why should I care about that? I'm not doing TV. Well, radio guys hate dead air even more than TV guys, which is why broadcasters like NPR, CBC, and the BBC, to name a few, buy Lavo radio consoles. Now, being this involved in TV and radio around the world means that Lavo thinks about the future a lot. Everybody knows that all types of media are converging on a common IP delivery platform, and Lavo is ready for it. With broadcast gear that can handle audio, video, and control of every studio device using a single, integrated, commercial off-the-shelf computer network. And after that, well, virtualization and broadcasting from the cloud. Lavo's already building those tools as well. So if absolute bulletproof reliability, 5 nines or more of uptime, and being future-proof are important to you, you do it owe to yourself to find out about Lavo. Go to lavo.com/twerk. Now, please remember that and type that in when you go there. Make sure that you give your buddy Kirk some credit for this. Lavo, lawo.com/twerk, TWIRT. That's all lowercase, to find out more about our sponsor, Lavo, lawo.com/twerk. Thanks a lot, Lavo, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech.
You know, I went up to visit National Public Radio a little bit ago in their new studios.
You know, I haven't been in there yet.
You need to see that. It's a great place, and they are using a Lavo console for their main news programs, All Things Considered, and Morning Edition, and those.
When did they move to their new place? About 3 years ago?
Yeah, it's been three years now.
Okay. Man, and those guys produce a ton of content. Two-ish.
Yes. Yeah, it's produced all over the country, contributing stations, contributing to National Public Radio content.
You guys produce a bunch of content too. I hear Chris coming in there. Hey, Chris, you're in a noisy spot. So how are you handling your muting? When you want to talk, are you unmuting?
I'm just turning the mic on and off. I'll turn it off if it's that loud. I lowered it, but I guess I'll lower it some more.
Listen, please feel welcome to
jump on in.
Jump in any time. I was going to say butt in. I was trying to find a nicer word than that. Jump in any time, please. Because Chris works at a public radio station as well, a community station. Chris, give us a little give Ray here the elevator talk about your station in New Jersey.
WBGO is the jazz station. It's been jazz since 1979. We are the curators of jazz for NPR. We also produce a show, Jazz Night in America, Christian McBride, from our facilities for distribution on the public radio network and it's on over 220 stations. We do interviews with the latest artists. We have a lot of recordings that we do with local universities. We hook up with the schools and the students of jazz, and just to get started. But the staff, probably over 35 years each, if not more, of music background and the knowledge base to choose. We're at all the jazz festivals, so Montreal, Mohonk, Newport Jazz. You'll see us. We do a lot of stuff. It's all about jazz and new, old, and up and coming. We have another show, The Checkout, with Simon Rettner, with up and coming jazz musicians. He was just recently in Cape Town Jazz, and did some interviews, and we have that on the radio as well.
Very good.
Wow. Wow.
We have two frequencies here, two channels that we from which we broadcast here in Hampton Roads. One of them is all classical all the time.
Yeah.
And the other is NPR programming. Plus, then in the evenings, we do new music, a program called Out of the Box, which is music that hasn't even made it to the market yet. And then we play several hours of jazz in the evening, then BBC overnight. And that all comes to us via satellite, and that's an amazing thing that I could never have dreamed of when I first started doing radio.
You know, when I hear you describe your programming, and a lot of it comes from satellite, the first thing I think of is, well, this is kind of a sleepy, mostly automated public radio station, and yet I see people in the hallways. They're carrying CDs around. They're ingesting stuff into your automation system. You actually do have some active stations here. And I saw live programs being produced here.
Yes, right behind us, we have the live studio where we do a daily talk show during the noon hour. It's during Monday through Thursday we do a program called Hearsay. There's nothing in that show you can use in a court of law because it's all hearsay.
It's all hearsay.
The other program is a program called Another View, and it's a more minority-oriented program, talk shows that we use for an hour on our public radio station.
So tell me about the studio that we're in right now. I see some audio over IP gear, so an Axia console here, and I've seen some Axia nodes here. In fact, you've got a lot of audio over IP.
The entire radio side of WHRO is an Axia house. It's all audio over IP. This was my first experience with audio over IP, and at first I was really intimidated by it. But the more I got to know it, it was just plain user friendly. And when it came to the election coverage, we wanted to automate the NPR coverage of that. And I had to go in and say, well, let's see, I need to change some inputs on the automation machine. Let's see. Done.
Done. Yeah. No crawling under racks and rewiring.
None of that. None of that. My wife is a somewhat technical-minded person as well. And somebody was trying to figure out how to explain how all this audio over IP works. And she said, look, it's like having a patch bay under your fingertips. Just tell it how you want it to route. You've got outputs, you've got sources, you've got destinations. Grab a source, plug it into a destination, done. And that's the way a patch bay works. That's the way the audio nodes in Axia work. And it just made my life easier. I live, it's a 28-mile drive, on a good day, 40 minutes of driving.
Okay.
One of the things I really like about having Axia in here, the PC-oriented automation, we're using Rivendell, and any number of other things like that that sit on the network. They call me at midnight and say, Ray, we're off the air. And, oh, okay. I'll get you back up here in just a minute. I run into the next room, turn on the computer. Okay, you should be good now. And takes me a few minutes. Sometimes I have to, reload a log or something like that. But you know, generally speaking, it's get in there, turn it back on, and go back to bed.
So in the public radio environment, and you've got quite a few studios here.
Yes.
You've got as many studios as a typical commercial broadcaster with a whole cluster, maybe five or six stations under one roof, because you do a lot of local production here. Plus, you've got TV here and some streaming-only stations as well.
That's correct.
So there's actually a lot of content coming out of this building.
There's a lot coming out. This station is owned by school districts. I believe the number is 19 school districts in the region.
Mm-hmm.
And we provide a lot of content here that is educational in nature. The people from from the school districts who are on our board of directors and who direct the direction of the station. There's a lot that goes on here, and there are things that our listeners don't see, are things that our viewers don't see. The education department upstairs that is there's exclusively for serving the school districts. There's a lot going on in these studios. Mm-hmm. 24/7, even when nobody's in the building except master control.
And I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but I can imagine that having an audio over IP network makes managing all these different studios and where feeds need to go at certain times, it makes that very doable.
Yes. We have down the hall a studio that we created just a couple of years ago that is specifically was specifically installed for our streaming products, our internet streaming products. The intent there was that, from time to time, our alt radio or 1920s radio network, which run on our HD channels, but are also on the internet, that somebody would be able to go into that studio and do a live show.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a button panel in there, mm-hmm. and they hold down a couple of keys and press another button, and that studio is on the air for that particular station. If they want to do something, during pledge drive, if they want to do some live pitching,
there we go.
There are the numbers. If you want to do some live pitching on the air on 1920s or on alt radio, they go in there, key it up, and it's done. They're routed through. Then when they're done, another button, Pathfinder puts them back.
I was going to ask, are these buttons controlling Pathfinder, which is then doing all the
Pathfinder's audience. Doing all the routing.
Okay.
And cool. As I got into, you saw the panel that I had on the wall with the monitoring on it.
Yeah.
A whole lot
of VU meters. I mean, for everything.
A mess of VU meters.
Yeah.
We needed to be able to see what was coming back from our expansion stations, repeaters all up and down the coast. And that comes back into the Axia network, mm-hmm. and we've created a meter panel that shows up on a couple of video monitors, and we can keep an eye on it so that at midnight somebody in master control can call and say, hey, we're off the air on here, and I can call them, tell them,
so
call Glenn.
You mentioned something I didn't realize. You have a number of, translators, repeaters?
Yes.
How, I'm curious, there's all different kinds of technologies, and we were talking about IP STLs today using microwave links.
Yes.
During our SBE day of learning that we had today. What different methods are you using to get your audio to transmitter sites?
What we use as a backup to our main transmitter sites is a Mosley. The reason it's only used as a backup is because between here, between the studio and the transmitter is a coal yard with cranes, okay? And that loading coal onto ships.
Yeah.
Know? And so the cranes get in there and block the signal from time to time.
Really?
Yes.
So a crane gets in the middle of the path.
Yes.
And the 92 megahertz?
900 somewhere.
And it disturbs the signal.
And it's gone. It does the same thing. It'll do the same thing with our TV signals.
Wow. No fault.
What we're doing between here and there is we call it Team Unit. It's a music cam system.
Yeah.
And we're doing the same thing, programming over T1 lines using the music cam to these expansion stations out in Emporia and up in Nassauwatex and Eastville.
So these are nailed up data circuits, not necessarily IP, but they're T1 style lines.
Yes.
Okay.
But the phone companies are getting to where they really don't want to support T1 much anymore. Just like ISDN is going bye-bye.
Yeah.
And the cost of T1 is going up. If we can get a good internet connection out there at these places, then we can, and this is what we're doing in a couple of places right now, is we're putting up an IP connection between the two over the public internet.
Mm-hmm.
And it works great.
Hmm.
On the studio end right now, we're using the Telos iPort.
Hmm.
Okay. And using that to encode the signal. And on the other end, we're using the ZIP-1.
Okay.
And picking up the signal. And with the ZIP-1, we can send something back as well.
Ah, so you can send back confirmation audio.
We can do that.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that we're doing that yet. Our transmitter engineer is doing all that. But that's what can be done. It's way cool.
You know, I we've talked about it probably enough here on the show, but one of the really cool things about a bi-directional link, and of course, a traditional 950 megahertz STL is one direction. You can send audio there. You have no idea what's going on out there unless you
have a TSL.
A TSL, right. But with any IP link, most anyone, and there are a couple of exceptions, but most anyone is going to be bi-directional.
Yeah.
So you can, whether you're using codecs or sending LiveWire or some other AOIP, Ravenna, AES, whatever you're sending out there, you can also send the same thing back.
In real time.
Yeah. So
keeping in mind that what goes out of here is each of the studios is 4 seconds delayed by a profanity delay because every once in a while, you just got to use that button.
Oh, heck.
Yeah. On the other end, of course, things are being converted to HD radio.
Oh, delay there. Yeah.
So you've got delays there, and then we have to delay it for the analog feed. And so by the time you've said something here, it's probably 15 seconds before somebody hears it coming out of their radio.
Yeah.
Somebody says it's 9 o'clock. No, it's really not. It's 9 o'clock and 15 seconds.
Don't set your clock by the tone at the top of the hour.
Right. It's don't expect it to be exactly right.
Yeah.
But when you want to hear things back, you want to hear them back in real time. You don't want to wait for that to happen.
Gotcha.
And so that's why having a return link in real time is of utmost importance anymore.
One of the problems that stations have had that have a lot of translators or on-channel boosters is an inability to maybe monitor them accurately because they're so far away. And you may not be able to pick them up at the studio. But you can have a tuner on site and
That's
put
right.
that back into your return back feed, whether it's live wire or coded audio with a Barracks box or a Telos codec or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can.
So ours is coming, back over the T1 through the music cam. And we then using the Pathfinder meters, the panel that we've got all of our monitoring here, we can have a visual indication of what's actually going on.
Chris Tobin, up in your part of the world, I guess you guys do this. You could do this too. You can bring back all kinds of cool stuff from the transmitters. One thing that I wish I had 20 years ago, when using a Marty RPU was probably more popular, because it may have been the only way to do it. Sometimes we had to put the Marty receiver at the transmitter site, right? Because we had an antenna up high, and so we could go do a remote from the car dealer or the gas station or the bank or whatever, or the sports stadium, and shoot it to the transmitter site. Then we brought it back typically over a leased phone line. If you did that now, you could easily bring that back over that same IP link in perfect quality. What are you doing at your stations in this kind of area?
Well, when we do live events, it's IP. We'll use an IP software. Typically, we've been using what was it? What was the last time we did something? I forget the name of the software. It was for production purposes. It's IPTel or something like that. But a lot of folks here in town still do ISDN. A lot of folks have kept the circuits where they are in their remote locations, so it's handy. But IP has been the way to go, and a lot of codecs. Just, you know, if you're doing MARTI stuff in town, not too many people doing MARTI or RPU here in the city because of the frequency congestion. And unfortunately, a lot of folks just don't have the understanding anymore of RF and how to make those things work.
But, oh, yeah, you have to have interns set that stuff up, and it doesn't work sometimes.
Right. Times have changed. You know, your description of a receiver.
Oh, did we lose Chris? Oh, there we go.
A couple of places, it worked very well, but you know, nowadays folks don't understand that technology, so it's all IP. You know, DSL drops here and there, or taking advantage of somebody's broadband on location. That's what's going on nowadays for remotes.
And you know, there's some stations that need to put a satellite receiver at the transmitter site because for real estate interference. Well, I guess a lot of the interference has gone away. You know, remember when we had AT&T towers? And it was hard to site a satellite C-band dish anywhere near an AT&T microwave tower because of the interference. So you could get a filter. But so I know of stations that had to put the satellite dish at the transmitter site.
Yeah.
And
actually NPR offers a service like that where we can actually distribute to our expansion stations, to all of our stations, via satellite. They have a system that they use. I can't remember exactly what all the equipment is.
Yeah.
I think Pico makes some of it, but basically we send it to them over IP.
Uh-huh.
They put it up on satellite, and then they would distribute it to the stations, be dishes at the transmitter sites. West Virginia Public Radio is using this now.
The public radio in Florida is doing this as well for their hurricane warning network. So in Gainesville, Florida, they have a school of meteorology there, mm-hmm. and the public radio station there they probably picked that one because it's not the first one to get hit by hurricanes because it's up in the north part of Florida.
Right.
And they have a distribution network that's based on, first of all, on IP with Telos Zip 1s, and every affiliate station, I think there's about 14 or 15 of them, have a Zip 1, and they're all full-time connected mm-hmm. back to Gainesville. Then, as a backup, they send the same audio to NPR, to the public radio satellite system.
Right.
And so they can – it's either on all the time or they can turn it on with a flick of a switch and get the same audio, same warnings to all the affiliate stations right. that way.
So distribution has taken great strides over the years. I was telling you earlier today about the twin lead problem between studio and transmitter that I read about years ago.
Yeah, so you had an open wire phone line.
Yes.
Between studio and transmitter.
Yes.
Of some length.
Some length, yes.
And it was open wire, and you said that
there was intermittent audio. The audio was coming and going.
Right.
And
right.
The engineer was trying to figure out what in the world is happening. It's just between here and there, so he decides to drive the line.
Okay.
So he's driving down the road and looking at this, and he sees that the spacers between this open wire, some of them have broken out and deteriorated over the years in the sunlight and all. And there are birds sitting on the wires, and the top wire, of course, is shorting up against the bottom wire, and there goes the audio.
And of course, being telephone line type, these are uninsulated wires.
These are uninsulated wires.
Bare wire.
Just bare wires out there and in the sunlight.
Wow.
The birds are so there. You know, that's how we. You know, that was a way of getting it from the studio and out to the.
You know, you just reminded me of a radio station I did some work for in Kentucky, in East Kentucky, right on the Kentucky Virginia border, at what's called Pound Gap, Virginia,
mm-hmm.
and the studio was actually in Virginia, and the transmitter was in Kentucky, but the transmitter was just up the mountain, about maybe 2,000 feet. From the studio,
mm-hmm.
and the link between the studio and the transmitter was a regular telephone multi-pair cable
mm-hmm.
that they had bought or gotten somehow from the phone company, and they probably paid an installer something to, hey, if you'd leave us 2,000 feet of that, that'd be great.
Right.
So it was a privately held, privately owned, and so it went out of the studio, and it went up phone poles and trees and stuff until it got to the transmitter building. Of course, that we had high quality transformers like the Western Electric.
Sure.
What, 111C repeat coils, basically. Yeah. So we had a 600-ohm terminal on either end, and it sounded great, of course. Remember that trick? Where you take the center tap of a stereo pair of 111C repeat coils. On the center tap, you could send a phantom signal because it was common mode to the left and to the right.
Of course, this would be the way to do phantom power.
You could phantom power that, but it works like phantom power does. But I use that exact method at one FM transmitter site to bring the Marty receiver back to the studio on this phantom pair that we didn't have to pay any extra for.
There you go.
We were just using the left pair and the right pair as common mode to each of them, and then we'd come off the center taps to another transformer, and coming out of that transformer was the Marty audio.
Very
pretty
brilliant.
As could be.
Brilliant.
I hadn't thought
about
doing that. I read it from somebody
else. I hadn't thought
about
doing that.
Well, we're going to get back to talk about some more modern things here. Also joining us, the voice you may have been hearing off camera is that of John Heimerl of Fine Tuning Associates. And so John will come sit in here in just a few minutes. Right now, though, we're going to take a quick break. You know, there is a way to keep up with some of the technology of the day, besides watching This Week in Radio Tech. It can arrive in your inbox every Thursday, like it did mine today. Let's take a look at it.
Not much in the paper today, is there?
Yeah, not much. Seems tough to stay informed, you know?
Like we're missing out on stuff, important stuff.
Yeah, feels like week-old news, yesterday's stories. Half the tech stuff in here seems out of date by the time I see it.
What Kirk doesn't know is I'm way ahead of everyone else around here. Every Thursday, I get this newsletter in my email. It's direct current. The folks at the Telos Alliance publish this.
What Joe doesn't know is I keep one step ahead of the radio guys in this market. Every Thursday, I get direct current from the folks at the Telos Alliance. It's a free newsletter about radio engineering, audio, streaming, studios, everything.
Thursday afternoons, we have our department head meeting. I look like a genius, thanks to the knowledge, updates, and advice in Direct Current. Sometimes I wonder if I should tell Kirk about Direct Current. Might help him out.
I wonder if I should let Joe in on my secret. He could use a little help sometimes.
Get Direct Current in your inbox every Thursday. Read profiles of engineers and newsmakers in the broadcast community. Get technical pointers putting you and your facility at an advantage. Important industry news and views. Plus, you'll be up to date on Telos Omnia Axia and ZipStream products. It's all here in the Direct Current newsletter. Subscribe online at telosalliance.com/directcurrent. That's telosalliance.com/directcurrent.
And we're back. Hey, it's Kirk Harnack on This Week in Radio Tech, our 325th episode. We're coming to you, at least we are, from Norfolk, Virginia, Hampton Roads area at WHRO and WHRV. Plus, there's a TV station here, too. Is it over-the-air TV?
Yes. Oh. Yes. We have a full-power television station that runs PBS. We run the high-definition channels. You know, we're HD on the main channel.
Yeah.
We do PBS Kids. We do PBS. Anyway, there are several channels. PBS World.
And then
we do Create. That's cable only. Yes.
So that is what, WHRODT?
Yes.
How about that? Also, Chris Tobin is with us. We're going to bring Chris in before we get done with the show. Chris, you're in an undisclosed location on a rooftop in Manhattan with a bunch of secret equipment. Chris, are you going to be able to give us any tour at all, or is it just the back of the gear we can see?
I think I can take the camera and move it around a bit, see if it makes any sense. Yeah, it won't be a problem. I think we can make it work.
Well, good. Well, our next guest coming up in just a minute, we've got a couple more things to talk to Ray about. But John Heimer will be up to talk about the whole movement of old engineering to modern engineering and how that works. And you're going to touch on that just a little bit too.
Yeah.
Ray Lenz, by the way. Ray, you were telling me during the break of how much your job here has changed since you came on board and since you started in engineering low on many decades ago.
Many decades ago, yes. Radio, you know, it was tubes and tape recorders and turntables and, you know, cart machines.
And by the way, and I remember a lot more coffee and cigarettes back then than you see now.
I remember working at a station where there was a lot of that, and I was glad that I did the sign-on shift where I didn't have to smell. There was that odor left over. The boss at the station I worked at out in Walla Walla, Washington. He smoked a pipe, and that was a very distinct odor. Of that. But
did you ever have to wipe tar and nicotine off the tubes?
I'll tell you, not that, but I was inside. I worked for an audio service company in Virginia Beach several years back, and there was a power amplifier came in for service from a club, a nightclub.
Okay.
And when I opened it up, I was expecting to see dust bunnies in there.
Oh no!
They were grizzly bears.
Oh no!
The nicotine inside there, it was really nasty.
I'm surprised it didn't also smell of beer, because the speakers in nightclubs often do. Wow.
But
it's a different world today.
It is. Okay. It is. And you know, it's been a real blessing for me to have taken the career path that I've taken, because one thing has led in me in preparation for another, having spent time working in on an IT job, gave me some preparation for this job, because I'm not doing turntables and tape recorders anymore. The old tape machines have gone out. We've got a couple of DAT machines sitting around, and there's a couple of turntables in a couple of the studios, because
just in case.
We still have some vinyl that we play off of.
I saw this. I got to tell everybody. I was so impressed. Earlier today, I got to see the record library.
Yeah.
And it is – how many CDs?
There are like 30,000 CDs.
30,000 CDs in one room. It's unbelievable. And then in part of the room, you still have some rows of – vinyl.
Vinyl, yes. Those were rescued once upon a time from a dumpster because somebody said, you know, we're not going to play vinyl anymore. And somebody said, oh, I think we better keep this stuff.
So it was
saved from the dumpster.
By the way, how many of – I know you have an automation system here.
Yes.
It's a Rivendell, you said.
Yes.
Which plays real nice with Axia, by the way.
Yes, it does.
I happen to know. That's what we're using at our stations. All those CDs, so 30,000, is all of that ripped into Rivendell?
No. I could only wish, because CDs deteriorate.
Do they?
Yes.
I've heard this.
We've got some. I ripped a CD the other day that I was looking at. I said, you know, this really, really needs to get saved. It was a Shostakovich recording with the Novorossiysk chimes. I walked into the studio one time just as the announcer was playing this piece of music, the Novorossiysk chimes, and I said, oh, a ringtone. I grabbed it and I adapted it, edited it so it would fit on my phone. And so now when I when the phone rings, it's the Novorossiysk chimes.
This is the height of classical station public engineer geekiness right here. Hey, ringtones. That's great.
So yes, from going to where there were no computers, I remember a station that I worked at in Michigan, and where we got our first PC. Mm-hmm. And what do we do with it, you know? And those were the questions we had. How can I apply this? And I was trying to do some design work on it. It was really, really clunky. And what are you going to do with a computer? And over the years, they've become pervasive everywhere. Up until the time we installed Rivendell, I had 27 PCs to take care of, and now I've got near 50.
Yeah,
and 47. And that's how many computers there were in the entire office complex that I worked in Spokane a number of years back.
Well, they're so pervasive that now that we just bolt them on the back of a monitor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And every Axia box is a PC.
Yes, it is effectively. Absolutely.
You got that box. If you open it up, there's a little PC motherboard in there.
Yeah.
And somebody plugged some intelligence in there that made it an iPort. Somebody plugged intelligence into another that made it
the 8X. Studio Mix Engine.
The Mix Engine. Yeah. That's what I was trying to say. I just had a senior moment.
Yeah. Yeah, all this bigger stuff is running Linux, and A part of it runs real-time Linux because there are some real-time processes that need to get done to mix audio really fast.
And it is lightning fast. You don't notice. What you're doing all of this on a PC motherboard? Are you crazy?
Yeah.
Yeah. all of the mix engine stuff, all that goes on inside there, and I say that can't really be happening in real time inside on this little PC board, because I know that I've worked with PCs that I've told it to do something, and it said, I'll get there later.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so actually, that's a real design challenge for engineers who work at the TELUS Alliance or at other companies that make such things, is making the software execute really fast and knowing where to use real-time processes and user space, non-real-time processes.
Well, you end up having to look at it and say, this is how much of the operating system I need to run.
Yeah.
I need to use the kernel, and I need to use this, and then I need this stuff. I don't want to do it in BASIC, for example, which is an interpreter language. I don't even want to do it maybe in assembly. Maybe I want to do it with real ones and zeros in machine code. And those are the things that that speed this kind of thing up. I don't know what they're using at Axia for this. But
There's a whole lot of C going on, I believe.
I suspect so.
Yeah. Wow. Hey, you're watching This Week in Radio Tech. We're here with Ray Lenz. He's the senior radio engineer here at WHRO and WHRV at this facility in Norfolk, Virginia. So Chris Tobin's been with us, and I'm just itching to get a quick little tour of where he's at least what he can maybe legally squeak into showing us. He's at an undisclosed location on a Manhattan skyscraper. Chris, I think you're in a building that maybe I have been to before.
Yes, you have.
Maybe? Okay.
I'm pretty sure you have, yes.
But I didn't go to every room. Certainly, I was on the roof for a while. And they were filming a movie there the day that I was there. We saw some celebs.
It's been going on. It's been pretty busy the last couple of months. I came by to do some work, the TV station in this building, and I got on the elevator. I'm looking around. I'm like, well, these are not typical people you see on an elevator here in the freight. And it turned out they were the co-lead or co-star and a couple of supporting actors of the movie, of the TV show Quantico. Apparently they were filming in the building. so I'm like, oh, okay. I discovered it when I went home that week, went home and that week watched the show just for something else. I'm like, wait a minute. I rode the elevator with that woman just 2 days ago.
Hey, Chris, we're going to do a quick guest changeroo here. So if you could take right now and give us a little bit of a tour up there and explain what you're looking at, that'd be great.
Alrighty. Well, like I said, this is the combiner room for television, some radio, and other people like wireless internet and public safety. So let me move this camera. We'll start here with this. Since we're talking IP, let's get some IP things going. These are switches using fiber to interconnect the various data ports. And that's part of a wireless network, internet network, a wireless service. That's all I will say. And then we'll move over. Let's see. We'll do this. And there we go. Looking really nice. And there is a UHF TV combiner for two UHF channels. And if I can extend my cable just a hair, I think we can actually see a portion of the actual TV transmitter itself. There you go. So there's the TV transmitter. Yes, it's a Harris. And then we'll come around. And in the distance, as we pass the combiner again, there's a couple of racks. It's for public safety. The blue logos are on there. They're probably not that easily seen. And in the distance, you see a fire extinguisher. And to the right of that is actually an FM station, two of their racks. And then sort of in the center there is a TV downlink for video distribution for a TV station that's here in the building. And if we look up into the ceiling, because we always want to see the RF plumbing, and there we have 3-inch pipe, or actually 6-inch pipe, that's going up to the rooftop to the tower, waveguide to the left, and the coaxial to the right. And then there's the power distribution, which we'll bring into view shortly. Some power distribution, very simple stuff, all familiar with that. And then there, if I can do this right, and here we go. And there's a cabling coming in and out.
Wow.
That goes into the room. That goes into the room at the base of the tower. On the other side of that wall where those holes are is an open space. And if you look straight up, you'd be looking into the tower structure on the rooftop. And outside,
oh, yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah.
And we move over to the right a little bit. You'll see the polyphases or the inline protection for the coax. And we come around. A lot of places up here have battery plants for the telecom stuff, so we'll show you a quick battery plant. There it is.
Uh-huh.
Even though this room is protected with a UPS, we come around. We see some fiber rack, lots of fiber. It's all about the fiber. Not the oats, but just the fiberglass.
I'm seeing a lot of belt and suspenders type of engineering there. Hey, four things can fail, and we're still on the air.
Oh, yes, absolutely. To the right of what you see is a typical telecom or telco back panel, the MDF, we're all familiar with over the years.
Yeah,
nothing's changed
there.
Yeah,
nothing's
changed
there.
And as I mentioned earlier, this rack here has got a microwave point-to-point interconnects for data services and some video. It's connecting different buildings here in town. Standard stuff. That's Harris products up there. And then for those of you in the audience who are familiar with this stuff, that is a TX-RX. A combiner, UHF combiner for local public safety folks here.
We'll
move up
okay.
A bit. Yeah, that's for the transmit. And then just above is the standard multi-coupler receive master antenna receive, TX-RX. If anybody's used it, the very notch filters that are there. Very handy stuff. I've used them a lot. And then there's some more combiners, TV combiner for the other folks in the building. Let's see if I can do this without making a mess. There we go. You can see a portion of the combiner on the floor there. And to the right is the UPS system. And there's air conditioning here in the plant. And then just to the left, you'll see blue lights flashing. That is a wireless internet service provider's rack. It's both business. They do strictly business. I don't think they have residential folks who do. So there's a lot of stuff going on up here. And we just come back to where I am. And oops, cable's pulling up things. And we go like so. And there you have it.
Chris, so if I wanted to be a tenant there, would it cost me an arm and a leg?
No, it's relative to what you do and the space you take. So, a small cabinet like this may cost you a couple of $100 a month. A larger footprint might be a couple of $1,000 a month. But it's based on your revenues and things of that sort. That's how a lot of places do it now, rather than just a flat fee like it was done many years ago. They look at your business model and say, okay, this is your percentages, what you do. Here's what we're going to market values go charge. It's all negotiable.
I'm sure they don't want to leave any money on the table.
No. But like everybody, it's like as always in real estate, it's location, location, location. So if you need to be here, both parties have an interest. It's a question of where you can meet in the middle.
You're probably on the second or third highest place in town.
Second. At the moment, this would be second. By the end of next year, it'll probably be third once World Trade is up and running.
It's not quite up and running yet.
No, not yet. No, there's still antennas are still going up. Work's still being done. There's a lot going on in town. But this is a good location. It's designed for communication. So, you move into this building, you'd have all the redundancy and access that you need to make it work right. So it's well worth it.
I want to know how you got there. I you probably know a guy.
Well, let's just say I have a relationship with a friend of mine's company that I've worked with for 20 plus years, and he's contracted to do a lot of work, and it just so happens I have the skill set that's handy when it comes for those emergency calls, and I'm the closest in town.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's awesome. Thank you so much for that tour. And Chris, I got to tell you, every week I appreciate, I mean, so many weeks, you go someplace interesting and give us a, you know, an on the scene report. And that is just, that's so cool. And this is one of the extra cool ones. Thank you.
Yeah, these are all the IDs I use to get around to the different places.
Oh, gee.
So yes,
it used to be a ring of keys. Now it's just card swipes.
Yeah. No, there's still a ring of keys. I got both. Both.
Okay.
There are certain areas that require both. Let's say phone call, swipe the card, then use the key. Don't do the key, then the card, then the call. That will set off the alarm.
Oh, wow!
Yeah.
Chris, thanks again. Hang on. Can you hang on until the end of the show?
Absolutely.
You got a few minutes?
No, I'm fine. No,
okay.
Fine.
Okay. I'll do my usual and hit you up for a tip of the week if that's possible. Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. So, hey, look, Ray Lenz is no longer sitting here with me. It's John Heimerl. Hi, John. How are you?
Hey. All right. Good to see you, Kurt.
Now,
right.
I got to know you when we were both on the SBE Board of Directors.
Yes. Yeah. That's right.
And so about 3 years ago, I was sworn in for a 2-year term.
Right.
And that's when I met you there.
And I was kind of in the middle and heading out to pasture.
Oh, okay.
Which is what happens when you've been doing this for 50 years.
Yikes.
I guess. Yeah. That's this year, 50 years.
So you used to work here, right?
Yes, I was the chief technology officer, among other titles, for about a 20-year stint here, and then retired from working here. We had great people like Ray and Chris and Glenn and other folks coming up in their particular areas. I was really fortunate to work with a great team of folks that learned everything that I could teach them, and then I didn't need to be here anymore, really. And I actually had other interests in the tower field, towers that I owned and managed and worked with associates and partners on. And it was time for me to go sell some of those. So, and you know, and then really head to retirement.
So every time I see your name, I see you associated with Fine Tuning Associates.
Well, that was a company we formed in 1983, and actually sold it and then got it back.
Okay.
So, but that's a long story there. But there were a number of people today on our day of learning, including Joe Davis, that's Joseph Davis of Chesapeake RF Consultants. Mm-hmm. I'd have to name like five people that worked for Fine Tuning that were present here today. So it was great to see them. But it was what Fine Tuning was. It started as an audio consultancy back in the days of progressive radio when the modulation wars began.
Sure.
And I was working with this guy called Frank Foti.
Really?
And who was making Texar Prisms and kind of, you know, off the side of his regular chief engineer's job. And it was very impressive. We had the opportunity to cut some new paths in FM loudness. People would call it went on to become a loudness war.
Yeah.
Across the entire United States and then the world. But it really was just a matter of trying to adapt the next generation of technology to a medium that had been around since the 30s, but had not really been used for mass communications in any kind of a large way. And it was starting to come into its own. And, then we had problems, with this, that, and the next thing. The antennas weren't very good. The processing wasn't very good. I started in the days of the Level Devil.
Oh, yeah.
You've heard of those. Yeah, yes. Absolutely. Gates made those. And Gates eventually became Harris. But Frank was one of the next generation of FM processing. And I was involved with a station where we, before the days of the Optimod, before Bombardment, and before Frank was working on the Prisms, we were actually taking the audio coils, the filters out of FM exciters,
okay,
putting them in front of everything, and then putting LEDs in as clippers.
Really?
As diodes.
Diodes, okay. Diode clippers, sure.
And then experimenting. One of the guys I worked with, I can remember this. This is a true story. Went down to Radio Shack and got one of the sampler bags of LEDs.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Okay. And there was, you could do that. You could just buy a bag and it was all kind of, you know, yellow, red,
right,
green,
right,
big,
colors,
little, you know, yeah, so on. Yeah. Okay. So you move the coil, which is where the ringing took place.
Okay.
And then you started selecting LEDs. Try this one, try this one, try this one. What levels the audio without distortion, without overshoots?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, for classical stations would be, you know, right now, anybody that was a traditional high fidelity engineer would be, you know, they were at the time tearing their hair out. They were just like horrified that people would experiment with that. But guess what? When you found the right LED and you got to right at the threshold of the knee, then it worked. All of a sudden, your overshoots were gone. Your average level of modulation was way up. You were the loudest station in town, and everyone else was like horrified or mystified or both.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's what worked for folks like Frank and Bob, who took the original, you know, seat of the pants engineering experiments done in the field and said, we can do this better. We, you know, this is the answer. Now we need to make it more sophisticated. And from that, you know, that eventually birthed the Omnia and the Optimod and all of the things that, you know, have now moved into what were rack boxes are now, you know, on the back of the monitor, like you said, they're tiny now.
But their process is running code, and that code is easily modifiable. If you have an idea you want to try out, you can do it.
Yeah, and that code goes back to the irony is that it's digital, but it goes back to the some of the earliest, you know, on-off stuff, one and zero stuff that existed when we were transitioning out of analog to digital. And so that's, you know, where I was at one time. And now the exciting thing is looking forward to things like Li-Fi. And yes, I said Li-Fi, not Wi-Fi. And well, then, you know, not that many years ago, Wi-Fi was a term that people had never heard.
Right.
Okay. Right. Now a term to watch is Li-Fi, light fidelity.
Okay,
this is transmitting data in the visible wavelength. It's electromagnetic transmission, mm-hmm, but it's in the visible part of the spectrum.
Okay.
So
now, I've always known this is theoretically possible, and I remember back some years ago, I would see ads, for a light-based remote camera link,
mm-hmm,
right? Maybe made by Canon. I don't remember who made it,
right,
for sure. But if you had line of sight, you didn't have to use RF. You could use this light-based beam,
right,
modulation thing.
Right.
Now, I'm guessing Li-Fi is a whole lot faster than that.
Yes. And that, too, you know, and I'm still learning, but the exciting part, and it has never stopped being exciting, is to look to what technology can do for you, for your company, for, you know, and that's probably a good, you know, a basis for what the Telos Alliance is all about, which, by the way, I got to take a moment here and say thanks to the Telos Alliance for bringing you in today for the Day of Learning, because, you know, this is a lot of what we were were working on. We focused in television on the repack. Mm-hmm. We focused in radio on IP as it has evolved. You know, I'm saying it's evolved because IP is no longer new in radio and in media, multi-platform, whatever way you want to approach it. IP is now the foundation. And so we're looking forward to what other things can we do if a different part of the spectrum, like light, can become a way of transmitting something. Imagine, you know, because when it's daytime, there's light out there. Yeah. Imagine if you could modulate the sun.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, that's the kind of thinking that, that Tesla was doing all those years ago. And for all, you know, I've seen the experiments of, you know, of using a TV station to power a fan, you know.
Okay.
You
okay.
can, you can transmit power. It's just what's your definition of power, and you know, we may yet discover that these visions that occurred over 100 years ago are real.
Boy, what if we could modulate sunlight in given geographical areas, delivering information even to specific households.
And using the ionosphere or some other physical aspect of our atmosphere as a means to bounce the signal without a satellite.
I'm thinking a big blimp with a fast shutter on it.
Yes. Hey, Goodyear, this is your opportunity, you know, to for a secondary use, you know. they can put the blimp over top of the football field, and then they can have hundreds of Wi-Fi signals bouncing off the blimp going up and right back down to some other location. No more wires, okay?
Well, what happens if you have cloud cover? Could mess things up. What happens, though, if you could use if rearrange the clouds to send information? And then I'm thinking, well, what about – and I don't know much about American Indian history, but, you know, I've seen them use smoke signals.
That's right.
Right? That was a long time ago.
Yes.
Before Wi-Fi or Li-Fi.
And they had a backup. Because that? If the smoke signals didn't work, then they could use the drums.
Ah. Yeah. Yes, you're right. Of course.
So, you know, that's all we have to do is pair technologies.
John, we got to take a quick break. And you're going to have a tip for our viewers and listeners, I believe. Y'all need to pay attention because John's got some wisdom here. I'm eager to hear what he has to tell us about a tip of the week, something that maybe has turned you on here lately. So we'll get to that in just a minute. I'm Kirk Harnack, along with Chris Tobin, and you're watching This Week in Radio Tech, episode 325. And I want to take a moment to tell you about our sponsor, Axia, and the line of Axia Audio over IP, AOIP audio consoles. And we've got one right behind us here. We'll come back to – oh, here we go. Right here. You know what would make a nice commercial?
Console.
If you would tell us something about this console. Is this 8 years old?
Yes.
Okay. This is an 8 year old Axia Element console. The folks at Axia are still making these, although I believe it will eventually be phased out for the Fusion console series. Mm-hmm. Been doing them in parallel for a while. But here's an 8 year old AOIP console. John, what can you allow about this?
It's used every day, multiple times. It does a live talk show Monday through Friday, but it also does multiple. It does voiceovers for television. Yeah. It does, you know, every form of production that you would see in a multimedia situation. Audio from this goes, you know, into blogs and the website and educational components that, you know, for distance learning and so on. And so this console gets a lot of use. And it does. There's music programs on this console as well. And I hope I'm not opening Pandora's box here, but Ray takes care of this console. So how often do you have, Ray's off camera right now, but you haven't had to do a whole lot to this console.
I don't do much to it. It's very reliable. I occasionally have had to change a power supply in a
PC.
Since Ray is off mic, he says it's been reliable, but he has had to change some power supplies. But being 8 years old.
But yeah, that's only been recently. So, yeah. I mean, yeah. And of course you do that and wait another 8 years.
Have you had any magic smoke yet?
No, haven't had the smoke.
No smoke that we know. Well, that's good.
There's not much to smoke inside of these compared to, say, a diplomat.
Oh, yeah. Yes, there's very few parts compared to a diplomat. Yes. And those of you old enough know what a diplomat is, and it ain't the kind that goes overseas. So one thing I've noticed about your facility in regard to the Axia consoles is you've got a number of eight-year-old consoles, but you've also got a number of pretty new consoles here. I've seen some smaller ones here.
Right, and they're all happily living with each other.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. They basically work the same way? They speak exactly the same language.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they talk to the console engines, you know, back in the rack room, and without really any Herculean effort on Ray's part, they're all accessible mm-hmm. remotely and yeah. configurable remotely. It's what we envisioned it would be 8 years ago, making the decision to go to audio over IP. We knew we had to overhaul the rooms.
Yeah.
We knew we were coming to the end of life of the existing consoles, and we wanted something where we weren't going to have a huge amount of wiring.
Well, you got a lot less wire. You probably tore a lot of wire out of here.
Oh boy. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's what I've got three of these consoles, the smaller ones, at my stations in American Samoa. I can remote control those, change mic processing if they need that. It's really pretty amazing what you, and I'm glad to hear that, you know, 8 year old consoles are working fine exactly the same way with almost new consoles
yep.
that you've got.
Yep.
This very show is being mixed on an Axia Radius console. And that means, John and I, Ray and I earlier are hearing mix minus perfectly. We're not hearing our own echo back or anything else like that. So they really work well. I see you've got a new X node over on the TV side, to pass
yes.
audio back and forth with TV. Yeah.
Makes a great snake.
Makes a great snake. That's right. So check it. Let me tell you, check it out on the website. Go to telosalliance.com and click on Axia and see the full line of consoles there. Everything from the beautiful Fusion console all the way down to a smaller console like the Rack, which is a rack mount, R-A-Q, or the Desk, D-E-S-Q. We spelled them cute like that because they're cute.
Because you could. Right.
Because we could. Thanks a lot to Axia for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. And I'm a believer. I've used these consoles, and John and Ray are too, so I appreciate their good words about it. All right, let's bring in Chris Tobin real quick. Chris, maybe you've got a tip for us before we have to sign out.
Yes. That optical device you were talking about, Kirk, with connecting back and forth, I had a chance to actually work with some of those back in 1998. Canon, the CanoBeam. The DT120 can do like 2 kilometers or something. Free space.
Yeah, the Kenobeam.
Yeah. Yep, that's it. Yeah, that's the one. So the tip, I'm using my handy-dandy Nortel travel bag that I got at CCB in September. What I do with this is only a portion. So in the event I'm at a site or in the studio and I have to do some checking and something goes awry, a nice microfiber tablet. Sometimes you got to take quick notes while you're working on something rather than sit there and try and type it into your phone as some people try to do, or maybe your tablet. Just a quick little notepad and a pen. That's very handy. And yep. What if you're running around the studio and somebody says we're off the air or something's happening? Why not have a portable AM/FM little radio with you? Not applicable in all places, but sometimes it comes in handy. And then there's always category cables. Now, why would I bother carrying these when you can probably find them anywhere in your plant? These I make sure I test. I know their condition. I know how they function. So if somebody calls up and I have a problem, say, in the studio, maybe my X Note suddenly has a bad port or claims to be having a problem. It could very well be a cable got pinched on a chair. We don't know.
Oh, yeah.
But with this cable, I know exactly the quality and what I should expect. So I can replace it, quickly temporarily check, and say, hey, not the equipment. It's just the interconnect. We can get that fixed right away. Cuts the down on time of diagnostics. These are pre-tested, so I know what their condition is. That's why I'm carrying those. I don't assume the ones in the file cabinet down the hall near the shop or in the IT office are functional, because we all know what happens with people when it comes to cables, and sometimes they just try to reuse it and think, oh, we'll be fine. Toss it in, and 2 o'clock in the morning, you're grabbing a cable and go, why is this not work? Oh, look, there's a nick in the cable. Nobody bothered to toss it out. That's why you test them in advance and keep them with you in a secure place. So
Great
actually,
idea.
Small portion of what's in the little travel bag at the studio. It is handy. It will trust me. It will help you in many cases, and you won't appreciate it until you do put it to use.
That's a great idea, especially to have that in a little bag you carry with you, or it's handy at all times.
Yeah.
And I spent 10 minutes last week messing around with a piece of equipment, and it turned out to be the cable. That cable's now at the Nashville landfill. That's where that is. John,
yeah. Gone. Done.
We're almost out of time. John, give us a tip.
Okay. Quick tip. If you own your tower, or even if you don't, but you're having a tower crew come in and do work, and you say, oh, I need a insurance certificate for the work being done. I need to know that my company is additionally insured, okay, you know, just for the day or two or a week that the tower company is going to be working. Make sure you check the fine print, because lately the insurance company, as they will do, have added to the fine print. And the fine print in a lot of these insurance certificates says this is only valid if there is an existing contract between you and the tower company directly. Mm-hmm. Now, when the tower company is coming in to do work for a tenant, Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, or they're subbing to someone else on some work that you're having done.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, if you don't have that contract direct, you're not insured.
Wow.
It says you're additionally insured, but you're not.
Yeah.
Check the language very carefully.
Wow. And that, you know what? We need to have you back on and talk about a lot of these tower best practices and gotchas.
Yep. Because changes are coming, folks. The new A1048 standard is out, and that is going to change things for tower companies and tower owners.
We had a section about that today, tenants. And I got to tell you, there's a lot of I's to cross, dot and T's to cross in some of the new tower rules.
Yes.
Yeah. We got to go. We're out of time. John, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And thank you for coming out today,
too. No problem. I'm glad to be here. Ray, thank you very much. Ben, good to see you. Ray's son, Ben, is here as well. He's been a spectator on the show. Chris Tobin, thank you so much for being here from the top of Mystery Tower in Manhattan. Our sponsors, Lavo, and also Direct Current from the Telos Alliance. And Axia Audio Consoles. Also, thanks to Suncast, our producer, for putting the show together, and to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network, where you'll find plenty of other fine podcasts and webcasts. We'll see you next week. I'm Kirk Harnack. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.